A lot of people are afraid of the future. They think there is no future. They don't want to have children because there's no future. They don't want to go to school because they think everything's lost. And I hate that vision. I believe that we have to restore hope. I believe that we have to show solutions.
Bertrand Picard, welcome to Schweizer Monat.
Pleasure to participate. Hello.
Hello. In your opinion, technological progress, is it primarily a threat or a blessing for nature?
With technology, you can destroy nature and you can protect nature. You can destroy the world or you can improve the state of the world. It just depends how human beings are using it. And this is, in a way, frightening because human beings sometimes are completely crazy. It's also reassuring in a way that it's not the technology in itself, it's the human being who is at the center of it. So we have to speak of human beings, we have to speak of the needed respect that we should have for nature and how to use the best technologies in order to do what needs to be done for the quality of life of people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes we hear that technologies of the future are going to save humankind and that we don't need to do any efforts today because the solutions will be found in the future. And this is wrong. This is wrong because it's like an alibi to do nothing today. So I think when we speak of technology, we have to speak of the technologies that we have access to right now and how we can use them for the benefit of humankind. And actually, this is what we do with the Solar Impulse Foundation. We have identified now 1,650 technical solutions that exist right now, which are scalable, they are credible, they are profitable, and they're ecological. And most of them, they just come from common sense.
Mm-hmm.
How can we do better? How can we avoid to waste? How can we be more efficient? How can we be cleaner? And these are the technologies, I believe, that are really important to be implemented.
Mm-hmm. But there are some self-proclaimed environmentalists who say that progress is per se a problem for the environment and who instead advocate for reduction and abstinence. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it depends on what has to progress or not, what has to be reduced or not. In terms of progress, we need more education, more health, more quality of life, more social support, more hygiene. All this, you know, it comes from progress. Of course, if you say that progress, this is more fuel being burned, this is more traveling, if it is more cars or heavier cars or more thermal engines, then progress is a disaster, of course. And when we speak of reduction, do we need to reduce the economy, which is a way to redistribute the wealth to the people who need it? Social subsidies or pension funds or things like this? Or do we need to reduce pollution, inefficiency, waste? So you see, there are things to reduce and there are things that we have to push up.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the quality of life of humankind will not be good. And this is why I really believe that when we speak of economical degrowth or progress or technology, we have to define in what sense we are speaking.
Mm-hmm.
What are we speaking about? Otherwise, we are fighting between people who want to reduce the economy and the people who want to reduce the pollution. We have a dispute between the one who want to increase education and the one who want to increase the consumption of natural resources. So we really have to be reasonable also in the debate.
Mm-hmm. But you're not in favor of degrowth in the sense of ending economic growth.
I believe that we have to degrow pollution, waste, inefficiency, but we have to increase in the economical development what allows to redistribute wealth to the people who need it.
Right.
And this is social, education, health, and things like that. Otherwise, you make a complete social disaster. We cannot stop to support the people who need to be supported to have a good quality of life.
You describe.
So this is why, you know, this is exactly why I'm trying to identify a third way between the one who says you have to degrow, the one who says we have to grow. The third way is to look at all the solutions that are able to reconcile ecology and economy. In other words, you can have a cycle here, a circle, with everything that protects the environment. Here you can have a circle with everything that is economically profitable. The third way is to look at the intersection between the two. What is at the same time ecological and economically profitable? Because if you do that, you are not fighting between ecology and an industry anymore. You don't have on one side a boring, expensive, and sacrificial ecology, and on the other side, a profitable and dirty and polluting industry. Mm-hmm. No. You are able to identify a way to have an attractive, exciting, and profitable ecology and a clean industry who is providing the solutions to protect the environment, to be more efficient, and to reach the goal of protection of the environment in the limits of the planetary limitations.
You describe yourself as an eco-realist. How do you define that term?
You know, I believe that realism is the opposite of ideological. Today, you have too much ideologies. The ideology of being a green activist, fighting against the industry, fighting against the economy, and on the other side, you have the ideology of the industry and the economy fighting against ecology because it's a threat for the economy and for the finance. Nobody will win. Nobody will win like this. Realism, for me, is about identifying solutions to reach a goal independently from the ideology. Mm-hmm. I am profoundly an environmentalist. I want to protect the environment. But my experience has shown that we will never protect the environment if we cannot include the support from the economy, from the finance, from the industry, from the political world. And if we want to achieve a target, we need a consensus. We don't need a dispute. I noticed since a long time, you know, when I come back from flying around the world in a balloon, flying around the world in a solar-powered airplane, if I come and I say, the world is beautiful, nature is a magical feat, it's a miracle, we have to protect it because it's so fragile, I would get a lot of applause in my speeches, but it would change nothing. Because the real language of the people who lead the world is not about compassion for the environment and for human life. The real language is job creation for politicians, otherwise they are not re-elected, and money-making for the industry, otherwise they lose their job. So I prefer to come with a realistic approach and say, look, we can protect the environment with solutions that make a business profit for the industry. And I come to the ecologist and I say, you are absolutely right. We need to protect the environment, otherwise humankind will not survive, otherwise we'll have a bad quality of life. But we need to implement solutions. And the solutions, if we want to include everyone to have a consensus, these solutions have to be attractive. If you tell to the people it's no more traveling, it's no more comfort, it's being cold in your house, you will not create the support that we need to protect the environment. So that's why I say I'm a realistic ecologist, and I have no ideology. I don't have the ideology of the Greens, and I don't have the ideology of the industry and the finance.
Mm. What's your position?
I want to combine the two. I want to combine the two.
Mm-hmm. In that sense, what is your position on nuclear energy?
Nuclear energy, it depends which angle you have. Today, when you speak of nuclear energy, it is more expensive than wind, solar, which gave the cheapest electricity. But it is decarbonated. And before we have enough solar, enough wind, enough storage capabilities, I believe it's a big mistake to close, shut down the nuclear power plant. Look at what Germany has done. They have closed their nuclear power plants, and now they are opening new coal mines, and they have increased their CO2 emissions. So it makes no sense.
What does nature mean for you personally?
For me, nature means the only way to survive on this planet.
But we are in your personal life?
In my personal life, nature is about resourcing myself. It's about getting energy. It's getting close to the most beautiful things that we can see to inspire us. I go skiing, I go kite surfing, I grow my vegetables in my garden. I love to have the hands in the earth, you know, and not only the head in the sky. But I also love to fly, of course, because when I fly, I'm in nature. When I fly with a paraglider, I'm just in the air. When I fly with a solar-powered airplane, with a balloon, I'm inside the forces of nature. I move with the wind, I move with the sun. Hmm. And this is what I love with nature.
So talking about your new project, Climate Impulse.
Yes.
What is this about?
Well, you know, Climate Impulse is about making more than what we have done until now, and in a better way. Today, we are in a world where a lot of people are afraid of the future. They think there is no future. They don't want to have children because there's no future. They don't want to go to school because they think everything's lost. And I hate that vision. I believe that we have to restore hope. I believe that we have to show solutions, to show how and where to act. And Climate Impulse is just a flagship of this pioneering spirit that we absolutely need to introduce to motivate and inspire people to open their shutters again, to look outside, to say, wow, we can act. It's a symbol of how we can act where people believe that everything's lost and everything's impossible. So it's, you see with what I'm telling you that actually it's not only a hydrogen-powered airplane that should fly nonstop around the world, zero emission. It's just a demonstration that we have to get out of our comfort zone and that we have to work to have things that are different, that are better. And if you can do it with an airplane flying on hydrogen, I think it's a really important sign to show that a lot more heavy transport means can be decarbonized. Mm. So, of course, you have people who tell me it's impossible because you need to change the airports, you need to change the airplanes, you need to change the industry. But they have short memories when they say that. Very often in the future, we have already changed everything. In the early 20th century, we changed from the horse to the car. And there were people saying, you know, it's much easier to give the grass to the horses in the hotel in the evening than to build gas stations everywhere. And now we have gas stations. We don't have grass anymore in the hotels. I'm not saying it's better to have gas stations than grass. I'm just saying that it is what happened. Everything changed. Exactly the same for mobile phones. You are too young. But 40 years ago, The mobile phone was a suitcase. It was costing $15,000, and nobody thought that we could all have a mobile phone in the pocket. And nevertheless, it happened. Photovoltaic, exactly the same. 27, 28 years ago, the photovoltaic was 40 times more expensive than it is today. People thought it would be a niche, an anecdote. It would never come for everyone. And today it is the cheapest source of electricity.
Mm. You think the same will happen with the hydrogen?
Yes, yes. I really believe the same will happen with hydrogen. But of course, not hydrogen as the magical, unique solutions for everything. No, if you have a car, it's better to use a battery. It's more efficient than to have hydrogen. Mm-hmm. But if you fly in an airplane, on a heavy airplane with passengers, if you have a train, if you have a boat, the batteries are too heavy. They would consume too much energy just to be transported. So in this case, hydrogen is a very good way to do. And I would like to contribute to this energy transition.
Mm-hmm. When you want to fly around the world in a hydrogen-powered airplane, what's the biggest challenge for achieving that?
The biggest challenge today is to keep liquid hydrogen at minus 253 degrees, very close to the absolute zero where molecules don't move at all. No, and it's so cold that you need to insulate this hydrogen in big thermal tanks that will keep it cool. And we have to make it light. And the flight around the world will last about 9 days. So we need to keep this liquid hydrogen for 9 days in the liquid form. Mm-hmm. So it has never been done. And this is, I believe, what is interesting today, is to try things that have never been done. That's the role of pioneers. That's the role of explorers. And now, of course, you always have the role of the Nein-sagers who are going to say, oh, it won't work. It's their role.
Of course. When is the flight planned?
We should have the airplane presented officially by the end of this year, 2026, and make the first test flights by the beginning of the year 2027. Beginning of next year, then we'll have 2 to 3 years of training flights, experimental flights, long mission flights, 2 days, you know, to train everything, the team, the pilots and the plane. And the flight around the world should be early 2030.
You have mentioned the Nein-sayers. How often in your life have you been told that's not possible?
My grandfather has been told, my father has been told, I've been told, the people I meet in my circle of explorer friends have been told it was impossible. I'm used to it. I don't care. You know, really, it's maybe even a stimulation. When my grandfather made the flight to the stratosphere in 1931, he was declared dead by the media before he even landed. We're used to that. So you always have skepticism for everything that is new. Unfortunately, since thousands of years, you have people that have shown that we can do much more. And that's why we're not living anymore in a cave hunting the mammoth. We are now having a better quality of life with education, with health, with social organizations and things like that. So I believe that we just have to aim all our intentions, all our energy, all our forces to try to be good, to try to do good, to try to be devoted to a better quality of life. This is what technology stands for. If technology is only a way to make money for billionaires in the US, this is, of course, absolutely not the meaning I want to give it.
You certainly come from a family that is this kind of people that are pioneers and researchers. And is one born with these qualities, or do they develop during the course of your life?
I believe it's a question of education. You know, you have parents who tell to their children, be careful, don't trust the unknown, don't do new things, it might be dangerous, you have to believe like everybody around you believes. And of course, you are not educating pioneers like this. The education I received is completely different. I was allowed to ask every question. My parents never told me, it's not for your age, do what you've been told, stop asking questions. Mm. No, they allowed me to be curious, to try to understand things. And sometimes they were telling me, I don't know. I don't know the answer of your question. And that's a fantastic gift, because it shows you that there are a lot more things that you have to discover, a lot of more things you have to understand in life. And of course, I continued trying to understand more, to discover more, to explore more. And of course, my father and my grandfather were inspirations for me, but also the astronauts I met when I was a child, the early American astronauts from the space program. That was fantastic. These guys, they were making the first flights in a rocket around the Earth and then to the Moon. And they were speaking to me when I was a child, 11 years old. They were explaining me what they were doing, why they were doing it, how they found the resilience to do it. And it gave me the wish to have this type of life. I think you really do your life a lot by imitations, by inspiration. And it's very important to give this energy to the children.
What is a belief that you used to hold with absolute certainty and that you do not anymore today?
The only certainty I have are my doubts. I have no other certitudes. I believe if you have certitudes, the future is closed. If you have doubts, the future is open, because you are receptive to everything else that can make you understand better. So everything I tell you in an interview like this, it's not my certitudes, it's my belief. It's what drives me. It's what inspires me. If I want to reconcile ecology and economy, it's because I believe we all have to find a solution together. Mm-hmm. And that by working together, we will be more powerful than working against each other. But it's not a certitude. It's my intuition.
But is there a belief that you changed your mind on?
I'm ready to change my mind for absolutely everything. You know, in the past, I was very much against nuclear power. And when I see today the situation, we have intermittent sources of energy with renewables, but we also need a base load. And the base load, for me, is much better with nuclear power than with coal, gas or oil power plants. So I'm ready to change my mind. I remember 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I was very much in favor of importing bioethanol from Brazil. And people explained me how wrong it was.
Why?
And finally, you produce much more CO2 when you do something like this with transporting this bioethanol instead of working with renewables. And I changed my mind because people showed me that I was wrong. And I'm always very happy when people show me I'm wrong and I can improve and I can learn something else. So I'm really listening to all the people on every side. I listen to the people who are ecologists, who are in the left wing, who are in the center, who are in the right wing. I just listen and I try to take what I believe is the best from every side, from every party, from every belief. It's the same for religion. How can we believe that our own religion is better than the religion of other people? I think we have to understand the other religions, and maybe we have to combine some very important things from every religion to have a broader, wider understanding of the meaning of life.
Bertrand Piccard, thank you very much for the interview and all the best for the future.
Thank you very much. I hope I can give you a positive story about Climate Impulse. It's an attempt. I don't know how it will be. And hopefully it will be a success and it can be useful. So that could be our next discussion. Thank you, Lucas.
Of course. We will talk again. Thank you very much.
Most welcome.